This is KSQD Santa Cruz. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Pop culture historian Sarah Royal joins us now. She is the author of a new book about Lucille Ball. It's a beautiful book with loads of great photographs, and it's called AKA Lucy. Sarah Royal also hosts a podcast about Golden Girls. Sarah Royal, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
Thank you. How did you get interested in Lucy?
I think it kind of goes back to, watching TV when I was younger. And like so many of us, just like you mentioned, the Golden Girls is my other podcast, right? Yeah. So I seem to have, grown up with like a lot of millennials. I'm an elder millennial, just for those of you listening, with, several reruns that also just felt like live runs to me. Although the Golden Girls, I did watch live with my grandmother. But like many others, I found I Love Lucy on television and in its rerun form now, several decades after the fact in its original run. And there was a connection with it, I think, just as a young woman, seeing a woman be funny, but also not in some kind of, I guess at the time, especially in the 80s, was more of a crass kind of stand-up sort of situation where there couldn't just be a commonly funny, like, woman living her life happens to be hilarious, right? And not only that, but showing real depth in terms of an interpersonal relationship with, of course, on I Love Lucy with her husband, but of course her neighbors and her best friend, Ethel. And it's just, it stuck with me as it does, again, with millions and millions of other people around the world, where there was some magic to that combination in the way that Lucy sort of portrayed humor, but portrayed love on television. And ever since then, she's always just sort of come with me on my journey of like, figuring out the person that I want to be, which is also somebody who makes people laugh and somebody who makes people feel comfortable and who connects with family members. And, you can see her influence on the television show The Golden Girls, not only for the actresses, but also just the storyline itself, as well as so many other, pieces of pop culture that have that humorous element, but something that you can sort of overlay and apply to your own life. So that's where I arrived. And the more and more that I get to know Lucy, the person, the more fascinated I am with her entire story.
Yeah. I mean, I Love Lucy is different than almost any other sitcom, especially Golden Girls, in that Golden Girls has a lot of jokes. That is, everybody, especially Bea Arthur, says funny things. Whereas on I Love Lucy, there are very few jokes. It's always a situation comedy. That is, there's somebody in the audience who goes, oh no, as something is approaching, because it's based on what happens to Lucy in her in whatever situation she's in. Where mm-hmm. I can't think of any time when she says something funny like Bea Arthur would or Alan Alda in MASH or something. It's always about her physicality and of course, her drive to be in show business. I mean, she does funny things, but she never says funny things.
Yeah, yeah. I think she says funny things interstitially, like you said, with the environment that she's in. She's already in a situation and she's either commenting on the situation or just like acting as the audience. Like you said, the audience is going, oh no. And she's saying, oh no. At the same time, yeah. Something is going awry and moving in a wrong direction. But you're right. There is like, yeah, Alan Alda, perfect example. Bea Arthur of like witticisms that sort of stand on their own is a very different sort of realm from the comedy that Lucy put on. And, what's fascinating too is the person that she was in terms of how intensely and seriously she took comedy and everybody surrounding, of course, Desi Arnaz, but Jess Oppenheimer and the folks who designed this show, like all of that's really intentional. Like it feels formulaic in one way and it doesn't feel formulaic in another way. And that there are situations and the comedy is always fresh, even though, like you said, the base of it is Lucy's trying to get into show business and perpetually failing at it.
I think that probably comes from her background as a serious actress. I mean, she, before I Love Lucy, I guess before My Favorite Husband, which was the radio show that she did, mm-hmm. she wasn't primarily known as a comedian. I mean, she worked in comedies, but also lots of dramas and film noir and everything else, right?
Yeah. I mean, her career in movies is something that fascinates everyone who just knows her, you know, from I Love Lucy. The fact that she did almost 80, you know, over 80 movies in her entire career. And at some point she did 8 movies in a year, like absolutely obscene. And yeah, she bounced around like towards the end of her career. There was definitely like, oh, she's got comedic elements. You know, she was in some what would, you know, would be like sort of considered goofy comedies. There's a few instances, and I outline some of them in my book, of like her having pratfalls or like doing something physical that's almost a precursor to I Love Lucy. But the studios absolutely could not understand that a pretty woman, a little starlet as she was, could also be funny. So they really never found that sort of niche for her. She had got there by way of herself by pivoting to radio and then into television. And it's a shame because, you know, she also was never like seriously taken as a serious dramatic actress either, even though she had crazy acclaim for several movies that she did in that dramatic fashion. But yeah, she just said the studio sort of just like kind of wasted her talent, but all the better for us and the culture at large because she found television.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, she became a bigger star in television than she'd ever been in the movies, even though she'd been
absolutely
for 20 years first. In fact, wasn't she over 40 when she started to play Lucille Ball? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. Lucy Ricardo, for sure. I mean, think about, you know, and fun fact, I turned 40 this year, and it's so fascinating to think about the biggest opportunity of your life happening after 40, right? And it's something that our culture now definitely doesn't even consider for women. Can you imagine then? You know, and just also thinking about the fact that she had both of her children after 40, that these were, you know, huge, huge monumental life happenings that all were sort of like, after your life is over, quote, I'm making quote marks in the air, because of course we know that that's not actually true, but that's the way the culture treats it. So she is that testament to the big break. So yeah, certainly actors.
Yeah. I mean, so many actresses, you know, once they're 30, you know, that's pretty much the end of their career. And
totally.
I mean, Lucille Ball is among, you know, a handful of actresses from her era. I would think, you know, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Ginger Rogers, who was a contemporary.
Yes.
Managed. I mean, Ginger Rogers' career was not as great when she got older, but she did work a little bit longer than the average actress in her.
Yes, exactly. Well, and then there's always the, you know, there's the pivot to consider, right? So you have like Katharine Hepburn, you know, for example, like, okay, I'm paying moms and grandmoms and like that kind of thing, like later in years. But yeah, the opportunity to be the center of, you know, the young housewife playing on television and, you know, having young babies on the show at 40 is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of her film of Mame because I think she was too old when she made that movie. And when I went to see it in the theater, you know, they have her in this, every time they show her in close up, there's like this film over the lens. I thought I maybe have a brain tumor as I was watching it because my vision was fading. But
you and all the other critics, am I having a stroke?
Yeah. But later in life, she did make some interesting films. I love a picture she made called Facts of Life with Bob,
yeah,
which is a real adult comedy that required her to act. All of her work, I think, is acting more so than.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, she treated it the same way. Yeah.
She treated everything seriously. And I think that, yeah, I mean, you know, on the topic of Mame, like, you know, there's not a lot that hasn't been said, but I think that it's so interesting. The way I cover it in my book is like her personal feelings about it versus like a critical piece of art. And I think that what she took as, I think she honestly, you know, she was super vulnerable on the inside, less tough as she appeared externally. But I think part of it was that some of the critics were pointed towards her saying, not only like, I didn't like this movie, but you should just stop acting like you're too old to make art, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think rightfully so, she took issue with that, saying like, look, you're going to criticize me for just trying to come back at all. Like, criticize the fact that, okay, I didn't particularly like this output, but to say that I shouldn't even be sort of out in the public eye doing what I love best and kind of only know how to do is something that, you know, took her a long time to sort of grapple with. And I don't think she ever fully got over that, you know. But to your point, there, I mean, this post I Love Lucy, like, you know, her multiple television shows notwithstanding, there are great films and there, you know, there's great art that she produced. And also she did her best to also just hand it, you know, hand the torch to a younger generation and train up actors and kind of give them the tips about Hollywood that she had to learn on her own.
Well, she certainly did that for Carol Burnett.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, perfect example.
Yeah, she had Carol Burnett on the Lucy show quite a few times before Carol Burnett became
Star.
Yeah.
Before she became her, exactly.
Yeah. Let's before we talk more about I Love Lucy, let's talk a little bit about the Lucy show and Here's Lucy and Life with Lucy.
Yeah.
I there are some episodes of Here's Lucy that I think are really wonderful, particularly the one with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. But but undeniably her work post I Love Lucy is not as good as I Love Lucy and not as consistently good. And to what degree do you think that is Desi Arnaz?
I think it's a huge factor. I think that I think there's twofold here. There's the creative element of Desi Arnaz not being involved. Certainly he was involved in the early stages of Here's Lucy, although not on screen. But the personal element, I think that, you know, having in a lot of ways, you can't separate, even though Lucy, the actress, and Lucy, the person were entirely different people, right? Like the characters that she played could not be more unlike really Lucy in a lot of ways. But interpersonally, like you can't fully separate all of your pains and other things going on in your personal life from your work. I firmly believe there's always something that bleeds through. And I think that sort of the personal break with Desi had a lot of effect on just sort of Lucy's psyche in general. And I think you can sort of see it as like, she's not necessarily as full of her, you know, a full self compared to what she used to be. And I think that with him on stage, you know, as a foil to her in the setup and the dynamic of having her sort of, you know, play off of him and he's the quote unquote straight man is missing, right? I mean, you have Vivian Vance, of course, and you know, even have Mr. Mooney and her
Gordon.
Kids, right? You know, exactly, Gail Gordon, like later in all the other shows too. But it's not the same dynamic, I think, one that delivers so wonderfully because they had such incredible chemistry, and two, it's not the same dynamic in like, that's kind of what we've been set up to expect, right? Like it is the sort of sequel factor where nothing can quite live up to that original, even though you know that it's technically a different show, you're still kind of expecting the same dynamic. So I do think there's some of that at play, right? Where it's like when she did Wildcat on stage, right? You're just like, everybody's like, cool, Lucy. And it's like a totally different character. And invariably people were disappointed, you know, because it wasn't exactly what they were expecting. So I think her antics were, you know, in the similar vein, but yeah, having the, you know, Desi to play off of is something you can't really recoup because it was just so good.
Well, and I'm sure the writing is also a huge factor, but I want to ask you.
Well, also, I will say just on that topic, you know, I mean, she had, of course, she was famously carrying, you know, her crew and cast and crew like from show to show. So a lot of the writing was the same, but Desi wasn't there to be that oversight, right? To tell her, you shouldn't do this, you should do that, you know, to have that sort of behind the scene direction. So I think it's really hard to like look back now and say, all right, well, maybe some of the shows and some of the scenes and some of the writing that were kind of like duds, you know, maybe he would have been there to sort of say, use his, you know, better judgment to say that we should or shouldn't do this.
Well, one of the things that attracted me to your book, Sarah Royal, your book is called AKA Lucy, The Dynamic and Determined Life of Lucille Ball. The idea that you are drawing a distinction between Lucy and Lucille Ball. There's a little bit of a self-help section in your book, I would think you would say, in which you talk about how you could be like Lucy. But
yeah.
Are you talking about how to be like Lucy Ricardo or how to be like Lucille Ball?
Good question. I'm talking about how to be like Lucille Ball. So it comes at the end of it because I think that the assumption in the title is that you know a lot about Lucy Ricardo, and you don't necessarily know a lot about Lucille Ball, the person. So as you move through the book, it's set up in just like chapters and chunks of her life, but focusing on, you know, just her movies, just her early career, you know, just her relationship with Desi, those types of pieces. So it's kind of meant to be read a little bit out of order. You can read it all the way through, and it obviously makes sense, or reading out of order also makes sense in a lot of ways. But yeah, ending up at the end of it, I'm really talking about Lucy the person. But as I said before, I don't think, just like you can't really separate your personal life from your art, I think that Lucy the person certainly carried a lot of elements of her kooky characters within her as well.
Why do you like old TV? Do you still watch TV? Do you watch new TV shows? You know, whenever you talk to somebody,
yeah,
they say, are you watching blah, blah, blah? And you say, no. They say, you're not watching blah, blah, blah. It's so great. And of course, it really doesn't kick in until season 5, but you got to stick with it.
Oh, I'm famously like, I have to go back and catch up, you know, because I am a rewatcher, right? Like, I feel like a lot of Lucy fans listening to this podcast is probably saying, you know what? Yeah, me too. I mean, people like rewatching a show, which obviously this is what I do for, you know, my Golden Girls podcast as well, is I found it really fulfilling. Because especially with situation comedies, you're looking for a release. Like, you're looking to smile and laugh and kind of live in a little bit of a fantasy world. But I think I alluded to this before of like, it can tell you a lot about yourself and like relate to your life. And as you rewatch old television shows, especially ones that really have, you know, like living in the black and white world of the 1950s, you know, yes, it's a fantasy because I'm sure the price of their apartment was, you know, the cost of a sandwich in New York City today. But I think that having it be so removed from myself does also teach me things about myself and how I react to it through the years. So when I watched it when I was 9 is going to be different when I watched it when I was 17, different when I was 24, and different this year when I turned 40, right? I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of just like lessons to be learned by consuming the same piece of media over and over. So I tend to watch older shows and revisit older shows, in movies as well, you know, just like going kind of back in time. But I mean, newer shows, I certainly, well, this is funny, right? Proving myself, like, newer shows, like I've watched Severance, right? I've watched like a couple other things.
Yeah.
But like, you know, the newer shows that I watch are like rewatches of Seinfeld, which is already like a 20-year-old
25
show.
Years old.
So if not, yeah, exactly. So, but no, I pick and choose, but I do enjoy television writing and like old sitcoms scripted, and less like some more experimental shows. But of course, you know, I mean, in, you know, I'm swimming in the pop culture world, and I try my best to keep up.
Sure,
but
yeah.
But I just wanted to say that thing about rewatching, because I do think it's like, it's so fascinating, because some people get criticized for it, and I think it's just, it's wonderful.
I think it's really interesting when you rewatch something, because the pressure of what is going to happen in the story is gone, and so you can kind of examine how the story is told and mm-hmm. the art at work.
You're right.
When you were researching your book, aka Lucy, Sarah Royal, did you listen to Lucy's radio work as well?
Yes, yeah, obviously her Let's Talk to Lucy, her later years, which was
right.
really fascinating when she actually interviewed people. Yeah, but then yeah, some of the old My Favorite Husband shows, which are so fascinating as an I Love Lucy fan. If you haven't listened to My Favorite Husband, to match up, you're like, hey, wait a minute, this is the same story, right? A lot of those scripts were reused, which, and rightly so, right? They killed, and they were like kind of begging for a visual adaptation and to be built out. But yeah, I think, again, putting yourself into that world that just like I was never a part of, when advertisements read aloud in a different way that like podcasts have nowadays, is pretty fun.
I find old radio shows to be really entertaining and wonderful. And it's not uncommon to have them, you know, if they moved to television. Gunsmoke, for instance, was on television as well.
Yes.
Right? And many of the Gunsmoke episodes in the first few seasons of Gunsmoke were radio episodes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
When you're watching them on TV, you're sitting here and they are over there. But when you're listening to them on the radio, you are right in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think the stage play element of it, right, where it feels more like you, to your point, like a live performance where they're right there, as opposed to a separation of that famous fourth wall for television. So yeah, there is something that is really magical. And I mean, many times researching this book and focusing on Lucy's radio career for my favorite husband, I just, I'm like, oh, what I wouldn't do. I found myself less excited to be in the studio audience for I Love Lucy and more excited to be in the studio audience for My Favorite Husband, like imagining that, you know, just yeah. because her, a microphone and a script, right?
Yeah. There's a marvelous scene in the end of Martin Scorsese's film, The Killers of the Flower Moon, in which there's a live radio show going on. And that's my favorite scene in that movie for sure, because
amazing.
They have this great recreation of what an old radio station was like with
right, the, right.
Yeah.
That's
you know,
awesome.
You don't think, you know, when you hear the you know, the orchestra playing on I Love Lucy, you don't imagine the orchestra right there. You figure they're playing a recording of the, or, you know.
Yeah, yes.
But the orchestra was right there on the radio show.
Exactly, exactly.
I particularly love the music of I Love Lucy. I think the music was one of the things that made it great.
Well, I mean, you know, you can repeat like a million things about I Love Lucy and thank Desi Arnaz for every one of them, right? As you talked about previously.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the controversy of having Desi Arnaz, a Cuban, play the husband of a white woman on television.
A white redhead, yeah, from Western New York. I think it's incredible because I think that, especially with modern eyes, you say, all right, this was sort of, you know, mellow, right? Like it's not, it wasn't quite as like crazy, you know, they didn't, it wasn't, as I guess controversial as we would necessarily think it to be, but especially because of like the strange way that, you know, the dominating power of white people in culture back then was sort of like, we'll other you and we'll like listen to your music or we'll go to your nightclub, you know, and the same thing happening to black musicians, right? We'll go to Harlem and like see you play, but when you suddenly like enter the space of like being partnered with a white woman, that's completely hands off. And of course this is all heinous, right? Like, and I think what's fascinating about this particular situation is it's twofold. One, that like Lucy wasn't trying to say like, I'm offering you a show that will break down racial barriers, because one, she didn't knew it wasn't going to work. And two, that wasn't her intention. She was literally married to him in real life and wanted him to be on the show, but also that she, a white woman, and at the time like a white woman certainly lesser power than the white men who ran these studios, she had power in this relationship in order to push that forward. They said no to him. They wanted, you know, they wanted the white guy from my favorite husband to be her classic, you know, classic American husband, and classic meaning white. But she was able to actually say, you know, this is a moneymaker. You know, this is a good deal. We have gone out on the road in a vaudeville show and killed. Like, audiences absolutely love us. She had to prove it on her own. I mean, she wasn't necessarily told to do this. They just decided to do it as proof of concept. And then she had the leverage to say, it's him and me or nothing. And they did it. I mean, it's really, really wild. And you know what? Their chemistry was real, obviously, because it was real in real life. And audiences sort of glossed over it. I feel like the quote unquote hate was minimal for what it really could have been at the time. And a lot of that was just owed to her star power, but just the fact that they were acting like it was normal. And the jokes they made about it on the show were never really at his expense. It was kind of like teasing about the fact that they were different, you know? And again, you know, and then you had, then all of a sudden you had this Cuban guy on TV who actually became a role model for a lot of Latino kids growing up, you know, and as well as like showing other white people what it means to be in an inter ethnic relationship. So.
It really is an amazing chemistry that they have on the small screen, and they made a movie too, right? The long, long trailer.
Yeah, they made two movies. They made Forever Darling as well.
Oh, yeah,
the long, long trailer was their sort of goofier one in the earlier parts of their stardom and marriage, which people remember more. And it was the better movie, to be fair. I do like Forever Darling though too.
That's oh, and of course they met on a film, and I guess two.
Yeah, on the RKO lot.
Yeah, and then eventually they owned the RKO lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a funny anecdote. I don't know if you came across this in the book that I call out, where which tells a lot about Lucille Ball, right? Where she was very much about hard work. She was never about like, I'm owed this, right? There's a lot of like stardom going to your head type of situations. And I feel like if there's anything that she learned about stardom later in life, it was sort of just being no bullshit, right? As opposed to being haughty and thinking she was above people. And I think that there was some rumor happening after she and Desi purchased RKO, turned it into Desilu Studios, and that like they were saying that, you know, when Lucille Ball first walked into RKO Studios, like all the way back then, she looked around and said like, someday I'll own this, you know, and like, so it's like ridiculous, right? So she's recounting this story of being like, can you believe it? Like some idiot made that up. She's like, can you believe, like she could not even imagine somebody being so full of themselves as a young starlet before they were even in a movie, like walking around saying that. It's just such a Hollywood creation, but it was such anathema to her that she was just like, this repulses me. Of course, I never thought that way. You never thought anything was guaranteed. And I worked hard for everything I did. I didn't expect to own a studio. This has just sort of happened by virtue of wanting to make good art and putting my all into it for several years.
But she was a powerful television producer once Desilu became an entity in Hollywood. Tell about how, in what role did she play in the perpetuation of Star Trek. I know she didn't play a role.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know. Can you imagine? That'd be great if she was around to play an alien. No, I think, well, what's interesting is, you know, she became the first female, you know, television studio owner. Like, and I was like, something that she didn't want to do. Like, she and Desi partnered on, you know, obviously Desilu and everything. And certainly she had input, but she was not interested in the business side of things. That was all him, you know, and he would kind of run the show behind the scenes and decide on, you know, pilots and who we were doing, you know, who we were putting forth. And she was really focused on her own shows and obviously like just reacting to what other comedians or other, you know, actors and actresses were coming up. But, you know, after the divorce, and he, you know, for a few years still ran it and then decided he was opting out. And there was a clause, you know, that they had set up long ago that said, you know, the right of first refusal for the other partner if they, you know, one of them leaves. And she said, you know, she wasn't ready to give it up yet. They had built this entire, you know, sort of internal family. And so she took over hesitantly and, you know, smartly kept all the smart people that Desi had put into place, into power. But, you know, she had a very funny quip where some reporter was interviewing her going like, Lucy, what's going to change? You know, are you going to be signing papers now? And she's like, of course I'm going to be signing papers and things, you know, like I always have, but this time I'm going to read them first. You know, she always had Desi to like make sure everything was kosher, right? So, but she, of course, you know, she did obviously like flex, you know, her brain was in that what's creative and what does she enjoy and what does she think audiences were going to enjoy in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, she saw the first Star Trek pilot famously failed. It was going to be a very expensive show. If you could imagine all the sets and the props and everything and the costumes and everything that went into Star Trek back then, right? Like that's not the way that shows were made. And it required just a lot more sort of heft in the beginning to get it off the ground. And the first pilot was kind of a dud. And Lucy, you know, the sort of the rest of the Desilu, the board was really not interested in continuing with the vision of Gene Roddenberry, but she stuck up for the show. And she said, no, we're going to, you know, we're going to remake this pilot. We're going to do it the right way. And then they did. And it went off without a hitch. And that's why we have Star Trek and all of its related properties today, just because she stuck her neck out for it. You know, I think there's been a lot of quotes that say it is not unreasonable to like give her the credit for saving it. So there, you know, and there were a few moments like that. She did it with Mission Impossible as well. Like there's a few moments where, yeah, she was not excited to be head of the studio and taking on all its responsibility, but she certainly did know her way around, if for nothing else than from watching Desi all those years.
Well, my last question for you, tell me, what is your favorite I Love Lucy episode?
Oh, wow. I think it's got to be, you know, when it's season 7, I believe, like I have to go and flip into my book because figure out which exact season it is, but one of the latter episodes where she's on the plane with the cheese baby, return home from Europe. It's funny. I mean, all the I Love Lucy fans are like, how can you not remember the exact number? And,
well, that's okay.
You know, but anyway, if Return Home from Europe, if you've never seen it, for the listeners out there, but they, you know, come back from Europe, as it says in the title. And Lucy realizes that the cheese that she has purchased is going to be a ridiculous amount of, money. By the way, I'm sorry, season 5, episode 25. She basically pretends that she has a baby, but it's actually the cheese. And it is what I consider just a masterclass in every kind of comedy that she does, because one, ridiculous situation, right? Check. Then we have playing off of like her passenger next to her, a passenger next to her on the plane, who of course thinks it's a real baby. There are just like funny, snarky lines that she says. There's so much physical comedy and like nursing the baby or like drinking its milk. There's just a lot of ridiculous, like every piece of comedy that you could do with visual gags, with facial expressions, of course, that she's famous for, and all ending up and culminating and, you know, like again, sort of being quote unquote forgiven by Ricky, you know, at the end of it, and having cheese melting in everyone's the band's instruments. But it's just it just is like a compression zone of that plane scene. I also really love, just in any kind of situation, or, you know, any television show or movies, a scene in which a character is in a contained space, such as a plane, where you basically, like, there's not a lot to play off of in the space. So it really has to be very character driven, very actor driven. And yeah, I love it. It's a gem.
That's a good one. Thank you for mentioning that one. It's a wonderful book. Sarah Royal is the author. The book is called A.K.A. Lucy, The Dynamic and Determined Life of Lucille Ball. It's a beautiful book. It's almost a coffee table book if you have a small coffee table, but it's larger than most books.
It's funny because the cover looks like it's sort of going to be a photo book of Lucy, because it's so gorgeous. Tim Palin Designs did the art direction and creation of it. But when you open it up, you're like, oh, damn, there's a lot of words in here.
There's a lot of wonderful text. And written by my guest, Sarah Royal. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to be here and always, you know, happy to talk about Lucy. So thanks for indulging me.
I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My friend Jerry Ludwig passed away earlier this year. Jerry was a fine writer and a great friend. And you know his work, even if his name is unfamiliar to you, because in addition to writing some fine novels, he wrote dozens of your favorite television shows. He wrote episodes of Mission Impossible, Hawaii 5-0, Murder, She Wrote, Columbo, and MacGyver. Tonight, From the Bookshelf remembers Jerry Ludwig by offering you an interview I recorded with him in 2014 when his novel Blacklist was published. It's a thriller set in the era of the Hollywood blacklist. Jerry Ludwig. Well, you're a New Yorker originally, yeah?
I'm a New Yorker. I trained as a journalist at CCNY, and I worked for the AP and then New York Post when it was a decent newspaper and so on, and then graduated and thought, now I'm ready to unleash myself on the world of journalism, and couldn't find a job better than a copy boy in one of the New York papers. So I wound up in the Midwest working on a paper. Then I came to California under the illusion that there were many newspapers in Los Angeles. Actually, there were about four or five at that point. The rest of them were like the Pico Post. They were shopping journals. And while I was looking for a job as a newspaper reporter, I got a job with Hecht Lancaster, Burt Lancaster, and Harold Hecht, their independent film company. And I, initially as the office boy messenger, and I was making a third more than I'd been making as a reporter, so I got the message.
You weren't doing any writing, but you were working in the film industry.
I sort of looked around and saw the publicity department and thought, what do they do? They deal with reporters. I'm a reporter. I know how to deal with reporters. So I finagled into that, and I wound up as an apprentice working on Marty, the release campaign for the Oscar campaign on Marty, and the release campaign on Trapeze, the circus picture, and then started doing that a lot. Worked with Brando on two movies, the only one he ever directed, which was shot along the Carmel Coast. We used to say it's the furthest west you can make without getting wet.
As a One-Eyed Jacks, right?
That was One-Eyed Jacks. Mm-hmm. And too bad. He was a good director. He just wasn't a good film editor.
That movie's a little too long, you think?
It was. There was a sensational four-hour version, which I saw. Today they would release it. They would make it, you know, like two. They'd make it into a miniseries or something like that. But the studio just sort of waited him out. He had to have a cut down to like 2 hours and change by the end of the first year. And the day he didn't, they took over the movie, and he never directed again.
I met Burt Lancaster once, and I was like, it's the only time I ever met anybody that really stunned me. Like, oh, he's mm-hmm. so big. He was like a gigantic. Enormous. He was like the Statue of David as he walked into the room.
Absolutely.
Well, you got to know him when you were working there?
Very well, yeah. Initially, I used to go, when I was still the office boy messenger, I would pick up film cans and bring the, you know, he wanted to show pictures to his kids up in Bel Air at the house on the weekends, and I would do that, and I would pick him up a couple times a week, and he was always in tremendous shape. And he would run at the track at UCLA. And he convinced me that I should do that. Do not do this with him. He will be better. Yeah. He was incredible. But I remember one day he pointed over. I used a variant on that in one of the lines in one of my books. He pointed over at Royce Hall. He said, when I was your age, I could lift up that building. And I thought, I was a believer. I thought he could do it today, that day. Anyway. But he was a marvelous man, and also very, very bright, self-taught, you know, not very uneducated, no formal education, but was a tremendous reader, and was a very public-spirited guy. He marched with Martin Luther King in Selma, and was always up for, you know, narrated one of the documentaries about the Hollywood Ten and so on.
As a writer, you've written for so many actors on television. Do you find actors, as a rule, to be intelligent or unintelligent?
That's a discussion that I had going over years with Jack Lemmon, who I worked with as a publicist on four or five movies, and starting with The Apartment and Irma LaDuce and so on. And Jack, you know, good Princeton man that he was, he said, you can't be a good actor unless you're an intelligent person. And I said two words to him. I said, Charlie Bronson.
Yeah, he was a fine actor.
He was a fine actor, but was, you know, not a bright man, really. Was just very, you know, stolid, kind of like, well, he made a career out of that, those qualities. But I think there is, Jack had a point. If you can be a personality, and if you have some personality quirk that's attractive to an audience, you may be able to get by with that for years. But if you're really going to be an actor, you know, then you better be bright, because you better understand what the words mean. And particularly in movies, it's the subtext, really, that we remember.
Hmm. Well, so when you're writing for television, just tell us, how did you get into TV from writing? You were a publicist, and then...
I was a publicist, and then I became a publicity director, and I was working with the Mirisch Company, who were the major suppliers for United Artists. And it was something novel for that time. It was after the breakup of the divorcement of the studios from the theaters and so on, and television had come, and Hollywood was in a bad way. And it's not unlike the American government. When in doubt, cut. You know, not cut the movies, cut the budget.
Cut the budget,
cut the payroll. So they cut all the actors loose, and at that point, the actors started to make movies. They became the producers of their own stuff. But Burt and Kirk Douglas were really the only ones that were good at it. Then along came Harold Mirisch, who was out of distribution, and he said, I know those thieves and how they work. I'll protect you. But he hired directors, and the first three he had deals with were named Billy Wilder, William Wyler, and John Huston. And this was at Allied Artists, and I think Willie made Friendly Persuasion, good movie, didn't make any money. Billy made Love in the Afternoon, good movie, didn't make any money. Houston never got to go to the Post because Allied artists ran out of money and couldn't play out the hand. It's like the guy in Vegas with a system. And they went and set up at United Artists, and they took Billy with them. And pretty soon, well, if you looked at the directory in the lobby, you thought, if a bomb hits this building, it's the end of American films. Billy Wilder, William Wyler, Fred Zinnemann, John Frankenheimer, Blake Edwards, Norman Jewison. I mean, the best guys
cream
were
of the
there.
Crop.
Cream of the crop. And I was the head publicist for the company. And for me, there were no film schools in those days. So this was my film school. And I could ask anybody anything because they thought, well, maybe the kid's going to get my name in the paper or something like that. Yeah. And but I got to see process. I got to see everything from the beginning, from the point that they say, this is what we're going to buy this thing, or we're going to develop this idea or something, through everything, you know, through the writing, through the casting. I'd see the dailies. I would see the scoring sessions. And it was truly like a master's class in everything. And along in there, I decided, I want to write. But writing a movie seemed too ambitious. And at that point, an hour television show seemed better. And Naked City was the show that I admired the most at that point. So I started writing for them and sending stuff in. And the first couple they were interested in, but didn't for one reason or another. And the third one they were going to make, and then they got dropped. They didn't get picked up for the next season. So I took this as an omen. I thought, all my luck is being used up by getting Shirley MacLaine and Steve McQueen on the cover of Life magazine. What I ought to do is quit this job and write full time. But it worked out. The day that my going away party was going away from that life as a publicist, that morning I got my first assignment to write a show for, there was a show called Run for Your Life with
Ben Gazzara.
He only had 6 months to live, but actually...
Show ran for 3 years.
And then but then he ran out. They were right in the first place, and he did die. Mm-hmm. And the show was gone. And everything anybody had ever said about, you know, the tough thing is getting the first shot, it's true. It was like once my agent could say, well, he's doing a show for Ben Gazzara, then this, within weeks I had an assignment to do the first of a bunch of I Spies, which were very, very fun to do, and also Mission Impossible. Then I was doing both of them, actually, at the same time. And I remember Bruce Geller, who was the creator and executive producer of Mission Impossible, called me in one day, and he said, I notice what you're doing. He says, it's very interesting. You're introducing humor into the show. And I said, yeah. isn't that great? You know, and like that. He said, don't do that. And I said, why not? And he said, if we start them laughing, we may not be able to stop them. And I thought it was very shrewd advice.
Well, it may be because, you know, like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., when that show got jokey,
yes,
it was very hard to pull back. And
yeah, there is no going back, finally. Yeah. You better take it seriously if you want anyone else to.
Yeah. We're talking with Jerry Ludwig, and his new book is called Blacklist, and we're going to talk about it eventually. And he's also written lots of great television shows and was the showrunner, right, on MacGyver.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say it like that. Did you have whenever they never said MacGyver, they always said MacGyver. And did you have a role in that? Did you say, listen, when you say it, I want you to say MacGyver?
No, that just I think that all happened with Saturday Night Live.
Oh.
I don't think it was, you know, like that. But we did not only invent the phenomenon, but we used to call MacGyverisms. and it's part of, good or bad, I made two contributions to the language. There's one, and Bookham Dano is the other.
Was that your line?
Yes.
All right. And they use that still in the new Hawaii Vibe.
Yeah, they kind of, that's, well, maybe that's yet another similarity. There are only one. As far as I'm concerned, it's an interesting, fun show, and I like Scott Kahn very much. But you got the big wave coming in, and you've got the music, and that's about the only connection.
Well, we were talking earlier before we got on the show about how television now is so different, because when you were writing for television in the pre-VCR, pre-DVR era, those were shows that each show stood alone. There wasn't a story arc in the same way that almost every show has. There are no shows now that just kind of stand alone.
No, it's unusual. That's sort of like we're breaking new ground. Actually, it's just going back to the old ground. It's come so far forward, though. I think we all agree. Everybody's writing about it at this point. That the movies have taken over the circus aspect of entertainment in most of the theaters, and TV is really wrestling with very complex characters and dark situations. But those take longer to develop. And it was a big deal on Hawaii 5-0. We would do two parters. A season,
uh-huh.
And that was, and you really wanted those cliffhangers to work. But also, I think that the cable television thing has helped change the audience, because people don't want, God help us, because that's supposedly, you know, the commercials are what pay for the the freight. But you look forward to True Detective. No commercials, and it just goes on, and God, it goes, and it mesmerizes you. And in my day in television, you learn to live with this kind of convoluted
10 minutes
dipsy doodle.
Yeah.
It had to go. It was like you'd start, and you'd had to end on a high point, because you had to hold them through the commercials to come back and then pick it up and
then start again.
And it's a freaky kind of, you know, way to tell a story.
Quinn Martin had Act One, Act Two, Act Three,
an epilogue.
Yeah, that's right.
He was an epilogue guy.
And they didn't really even have a consciousness about season finales or season premieres. It was just
another good episode
of a show.
No, I think that sort of began around the time of Dynasty and
soaps.
Yeah, soaps.
Yeah. Well, now, let's talk a little bit about... Yeah. Well, before I ask you about your novel, did you ever think you could be a director or an actor?
Not an actor. I've done walk-ons and most of the things mm-hmm. that I've done. No, I don't want to do that. You know, I've seen too many really, really good ones to take up that space. I thought of directing, but actually when you gravitate toward the era I was working in, the movie star really had the last word. Sometimes it was a good word. If it was Bob Redford and Sidney Pollack, they worked really as a team, and it wasn't, you are my servant or anything like that. But those were really exceptions to the rule.
If it was Jack Lord, maybe not so much.
Oh, thank the Lord, right? Yeah, he used to order people off his island.
Well, so now in your novel, which is called Blacklist, and it's a mystery, and the characters and the studio setting are fictional, but the Blacklist was all too real. How did the Blacklist get started? And do you think there was an element of anti-Semitism to the Blacklist?
Mm-hmm. In the sense that I knew many, many people on both sides of the aisle who'd been touched by it. And no one was touched well. But it was only in doing the research that I discovered that the Blacklist was really payback. It was because we know why the Congressional Committee came west, because the headlines were in Hollywood rather than talking about a dentist in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. But what was in it for Hollywood was the people, of the 10 people that were the Hollywood 10, 8 of them were writers. There was one common thread through it. They were all people who were activists who advocated the forming of the Writers Guild. They unionized the town. And it took a long time, a long miserable time of rejection, because Hollywood was and is a fiercely anti-union town. Anyway, but there was a president. Roosevelt was in the White House. Until the Supreme Court said it was illegal, there was a National Labor Relations Board. The NLRB said, you will negotiate a contract. And so in the late 30s, there was a contract. And as soon as there was a contract for the writers, there was a Screen Actors Guild. And suddenly there was a Producers Guild and a Directors Guild, and so on. And the people that were called before the committee, and that was the handful of people that ultimately went to prison for 6 months for contempt of Congress, they were the people that were in the point of the spear. that got it, and this was, and they were getting back at them. And most writers, many writers in Hollywood are Jewish, you know. So if it doesn't start out that way, it winds up that way.
So the interesting thing that you talk about in your book, Blacklist, is that the McCarthy era, the McCarthy part of the McCarthy era was over, but the Blacklist lingered on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for it was. I'm writing about it. The committee called the people that became the Hollywood Ten in 1947, and then they refused on constitutional grounds, First Amendment freedom of expression. They said nobody has the right to ask me who I vote for or what my religion is, and you know, or what my political beliefs are. So they said, well, contempt, and it took 3 years for it to work up to the Supreme Court. And by 1950, there had been two major changes. There had been several replacements on the Supreme Court. It moved further right, and we'd gone to war in Korea. And so the Supreme Court just kicked the can down the road. They didn't find for or against the argument. They just didn't hear the case. And instantly, within weeks, these 10 men went off to jail for six-month terms. And there's a lot of, maybe this is Jewish or maybe it's just black humor, you know, but it's there. By the time that Ring Lardner and Herbert Biberman went to the federal prison in Texas, they knew someone in that prison. The guy who'd been the chairman of the committee who held them in contempt had already been jailed for fraud in his feather bedding his office and hiring relatives who didn't even know where Washington was. Mm-hmm. And he was in prison, and he was worried that they were gonna hurt him. Anyway, so the book, so that was 1950, and now my book is set in 1959, and it's starting to wane, but it's hard. It's writers are able to write at bargain price and bargain basin prices, for you know, under other names and so on. The directors weren't as lucky. You have to, if you're directing, you've got to be on the set. Likewise, the performers. So it was, it was starting to open. But really, the cusp was, the turning point was Trumbo, who Dalton Trumbo had been the highest priced writer in Hollywood, maybe the most gifted. Had won the Academy Award before the war for Kitty Foyle. And he just by dint of his output and his mischievousness, he was just such a... He made it... Any time there was a good script written in Hollywood, someone would say, I bet Dalton did that. And they'd come and say, did you do that? And he'd say, gee, I never talk about that.
Maybe.
And therefore, and so if the illusion got to be that anything that was being done, it was being done... You know, there was a value was being done by, and then in 1959 into 60, there were two producers who took the chance because no one knew how terrible the results of bucking the Blacklist would be, but Kirk Douglas put Trumbo's name on Spartacus, and Otto Preminger did it on Exodus, and all the people that were supposed to come out and picket and scream, and they would be, you know, make sure that the pictures would fail. They didn't get their scripts. They didn't show up. And both pictures were enormous hits. And so at least Dalton was back in business. And some other people came through as well. And gradually it went away. But to this day, there are still people of those that are alive still, or the children of, which was what fascinated me, because one of the children of the Blacklist was my closest friend who just died a few weeks ago. Mm. I already dedicated the book to him, but it's, you know. But
yeah, well, your novel, it's a little bit of Shakespeare. This is kind of like a Romeo and Juliet kind of thing. And there's a little dash.
That's a good story.
Yeah, there's a little dash of Hamlet in there. And a little Dorothy Hughes. Maybe a little Dorothy Hughes.
I like a dash of Hamlet.
Yeah. And now you have, your story is told in three sides. You've got the son of a blacklisted writer, the daughter of a friendly witness, right, and the police lieutenant obsessed with his capture. Oh no, that's the fugitive. But it's like that. It's the FBI agent who's telling the story. So why did you want to tell it from the three sides?
It just felt Well, it's a little bit, it's sort of Rashomon. You can kind of deal with the same events and yet see three very different viewpoints of it, because it's somewhat, and it's too, and it's the initial thing that drew me to it was the children of, and this was, it's not Romeo and Juliet, the families didn't agree. Well, one father gave names and prospered, and his daughter stayed a princess as he was a prince, and the boy's father didn't, and the mother killed herself, and the father went to Europe and took the son along with him, which was the pathway that Eric Bercovici, and his father was Leonardo Bercovici, who wrote such scandalously political pictures as The Bishop's Wife and Portrait of Jenny. You know,
I love that.
Yes, he was
both fantasies. He wrote a lot of fantasies. Huh?
Yep.
Well. But by having
the viewpoints,
the FBI character in there, too.
He became the biggest surprise. You know, you hear writers talking about when the characters take over, and his name, he's an FBI agent, and he was, as he describes himself, he says he was the head of the commie chasing squad for Hoover, if you're going to tell a story about the House Un-American Activities Committee. You're going to serve subpoenas. If you're going to serve subpoenas, you're going to have an FBI agent. So there was always going to be an FBI agent. And my first thought was that it is like Javert. The son comes back now to town, and it's like he who plagued the father is now going to plague the son, and so on. But essentially, he was as I look back, initially he was a function. But he became like the second or third most important character in the book, and really carries a lot of the moral questions of the second half of the book, particularly, because it's kind of to have someone from the left say, "Oh my God, blacklisting is a terrible thing. It crushes people. It destroys lives," you know, and so on, is one way to go about it. But it's felt a little sort of like preaching. I have that stuff too, but it's like preaching to the choir. But but he winds up feeding a line, just to getting an attaboy, to getting a pat on the head from J. Edgar Hoover, who says, "Well, who do you think did it?" And he says, "Well, it could be this kid." And he's given a name. Mm. And he doesn't realize it, but in that moment, he's given a name.
He named a name.
He named a name, and he comes to realize how difficult it is to try to take the name back.
To unname it.
To unname it. You can't do that. And then you up the stakes on him, because if he stays within in the naming names business, he could have all kinds of good things happen in his life, or you could make the boss mad. And
so he finds himself in the same dilemma as these other two.
Yes.
Well, Jerry Ludwig, in this book, Blacklist, you begin your book with a quote from Kazan.
Yes.
I think I have it right here.
And it's a good quote.
It is, and it's Kazan's sort of
mea culpa.
Yeah. I did what I did because it was the most tolerable of two alternatives that were either way painful, even disastrous, and either way wrong for me. That's what a difficult decision means. Either way you go, you lose. But by having Kazan in the epigraph of your book and having an FBI agent, is your book more sympathetic to the other side, to the right side, than you would think it was going to be? Or
no, I wish there was a... Well, I don't want to give away the book, but I think McKenna becomes a very rich character, and Kazan I love Kazan, and I knew him briefly, and I think I can watch his movies and do watch them endlessly. This idea of, you know, I don't like someone, so I don't want to see their movies, but I can't quite come to terms with. I've come to understand why he did Character is Destiny, and when you look back, he came from an oppressed minority in Europe and is descended, so I can see how he came to do what he did. On the other hand, what he did do was he chose, finally, not initially. Initially, he refused to give names in executive session, and then he was pressured, and what he was looking at was he wanted to make movies, not a crime, and not particularly a blessing with the quality, because some of his best work came on the waterfront in East of Eden. And Based in the Crowd came after he had testified.
Right.
But he realized that if he took a hard line, and said, I take the Fifth Amendment, go on, blacklist me, he would not be able to make movies, at least in this country, or probably anywhere else, possibly, because John Berry went to France and made French movies, and so on. But the distribution companies, MGM had an MGM London and Paris and so on. So if you were blacklisted, you were really blacklisted. And he wanted to make movies, and he had something to offer, certainly. But on the other hand, he was such a towering figure in American culture at that point, Kazan. He was the number one director on Broadway, where he probably, but who knows, no guarantees, he might have been able to keep on working, even though he couldn't work in movies, and he was the number one movie director. And if he had said, I refuse to answer the questions, and I take the Fifth Amendment, money-grubbing being what it is, would there have been a producer in Hollywood or one distribution company that wasn't doing well that year that said, to hell with the blacklist, let's give Gadget a camera and let him make some money for us. He might have alone made a difference. He might have, if he'd gone back to work, that would have been the balloon would have a little hole in it, and maybe it would have made the thing last a little less the length it did.
Well, it's an endlessly fascinating era, and it's fun to have a murder mystery set there. And the book is called Blacklist, and it's a novel by my guest, Jerry Ludwig. Jerry, thanks so much for talking to us here on From the Bookshelf.
A pleasure. Thank you. Good to see you, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.